Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
I've been told to start right on time, so I'm actually going to start early. I feel that people can read the the bios in the program, so I'm going to very briefly introduce our guests today. My name is, I've missed the whole cell phone part, sorry. Please silence your cell phones. And also, I would like to thank heartily the Center for the Art of Translation for sponsoring this panel. The center is dedicated to international literature and translation, and I should say we publish a biannual journal of translation and novels in translation, and you can see us at booth 33, Two Lines Press, and the Center for the Art of Translation. Okay. Now back to the bios. So cell phones. Okay. And at the end, there's going to be a book signing in the lobby. So Sylvia Brownrigg is the author of seven works of fiction, several of which have been named notable books by the New York Times Books of the Year and by the LA Times Books of the Year, sorry. That is Calvino. This is her most recent work, which we'll be talking about today, and it has these gorgeous paintings inside. So I urge you to take a look at this and buy a copy and get it signed. Next, we have Jeff Dyer, and I think most of you have heard of Jeff Dyer. He's published numerous works and has won numerous prizes, and the most recent, and all different kinds of essays that are witty and philosophical and erudite and supremely entertaining. And this is his most recent book, White Sands. Highly recommended. Next, we have Carrie Tepperman Campbell, and she's an author and educator based in the Bay Area, and she won the Blue Light Book Award and the 2016 New Millennium Poetry Prize. And this is her work, Dreaming of France, which is prose poems, all taking place in France. And finally, we have John Freeman, who has been in the past best known as a critic and the editor of Freeman's Magazine and as a general literary man about town, but now he has come out as a poet as well, and this is his first book of poetry. Welcome. So thank you all for being here, and I'm actually going to start with you, John. D.A. Powell said about this book, Maps, he wrote that the book records a life's journey to plumb the depths of the known in order to reveal the hidden and unknown. And you've described poetry as a kind of periscope that breaks the surface while most of the action is beneath the surface, and that the unconscious mind maps things more interestingly than our rational mind. So, and you've written about how you write poems in airports and on the way places and in between things. And I wonder if what it is about travel that allows the unconscious to speak and express itself, if it has something to do with just keeping your rational mind occupied with the security line and so on, so that the unconscious can, or is it about being displaced or stimulated? You want here?
Well, that's a big question. I just want to say thank you for asking it, and thank you for having me. And it's such a pleasure to be here with Carrie and Sylvia and Jeff, whose work speaks to me in lots of different ways. And some of the answer to your question can be seen across lots of their work. In Carrie's poems, which are prose poems, she creates a kind of persona. It's a she. And I think as a traveler or someone in motion, you are a wanderer, you're a tourist, you're a traveler, but eventually all the things which create your normal self are usually stripped away, except for maybe your skin color and how you look, which makes it easier for someone like me to travel than a woman of color, for example. But once you're on the road and you're moving, you can kind of be anything. And that sort of unconscious, tentacular mind is enacted in Sylvia's new book. And Jeff has a novel called The Search, which is kind of like, imagine if Kafka was a psychogeographist. And so I think there are lots of different strategies to enacting that in literature. And one of the great things, I think, the capaciousness of travel literature, as long as you don't think of it as a white guy going to a brown continent, getting the goods and coming back and describing it, it can be lots and lots of different things. And to me, it was kind of a breakthrough, and I realized that poetry could kind of be that rubbing myself up, my sensibilities up against places often produced thoughts not about those places, but about people who weren't there. And so these poems are all stimulated by my mother died in 2010. She was one of my favorite people in the world, and the world was surreal without her. And so everywhere I went, I suddenly saw the world as a summary of subtractions. And it was partially aided by the fact that places I was going had also been themselves subjected to subtractions. Beirut, Lahore, parts of Brazil. And so I started to write these poems I didn't realize it was a search, but it was an attempt to try to create some sort of coherence. And the production of the poetic self, which isn't autobiographical, aided me in that.
Well, this interestingly leads to my next question, which is for Jeff. So you've written about how life is in a way that you've come to see life as a kind of, as an experience of subtraction rather than accretion, that you have started to notice what is lost, what is not shown, who is not seen, who is not heard from, and so on. And I was interested that Jeff wrote at one point in White Sands about how all the big questions are answered by these small moments and a kind of accumulation of, well, useless frequent flyer miles, but also of these little experiences and so on. And I'm going to keep bringing up one of my favorite books, which is Invisible Cities by Italo Calvino, which was prompted by Sylvia's book, which is kind of a riff on that. But one of the great lines from the book, has disappeared. There it is. Marco Polo is describing the whole world to Kublai Khan. And he says, Kublai Khan says to Marco Polo, "Confess what you are smuggling, moods, states of grace, elegies." And so as a white man going to not just brown countries and not trying to pillage and bring back more than states of grace and elegies, I'm curious about this optimistic view you have that all the big questions can be answered by these small experiences and the preparation for your next voyage.
Well, I'm not quite sure I agree with that summary. I think it's not that the big questions, who am I, where are we going, can be answered by more detailed things. I actually think that the reality is that the questions themselves tend to be raised in those incremental terms. And I guess the other thing is that I really can't have someone speak at all slightingly of my engagement with frequent flyer miles, because really it's the only thing that gives my life an illusion of purpose. And it's one of the things that John and I, we had spoke on a whole panel in Tokyo about. We had this sort of pissing contest about who had the sort of the best status in their various frequent flyer miles. But I mean, so just to slightly elaborate on that. So, when I first read, when we studied Waiting for Godot at school, we were told it was all about this thing called the human condition. And I'd never heard that phrase before, and they explained what it was. And I thought, oh, that's as Philip Larkin said, useful to get that learned. But as I've got older, I've become increasingly resistant to this idea of the human condition. So these big questions, the questions that Gauguin answers in the painting that was going to be the first title of the book, White Sands, who are we, where are we going, all that kind of stuff. I mean, I much prefer to raise those questions in terms of very specific things. And so, for example, the title essay in my book, otherwise known as The Human Condition, is an essay devoted entirely to my great quest, my search for the perfect donut. And you'll be glad to know, those of you who are concerned with my well-being, that that's a quest that has been achieved. And although I come across these people who sometimes, you know, claim, I'm looking around, no, nobody would dare here because I'm on a panel and I'm, you know, you have to treat me respectfully, but I occasionally meet these kids who claim to know more about donuts than me, but you don't. Still, the greatest donuts on earth are, of course, they come from the donut plant in New York. This is not a point for discussion, it's a fact, just accept it. So yes, I'm pledged absolutely to the particular, but just to make a more serious literary point, it's a generally accepted idea that actually if you want to appeal to the universal, which all writers do, then it's 100% certain that you'll manage that by being absolutely faithful to the vagaries of your own nature and the peculiarities of your own interests. So, you know, it's the great Annie Dillard observation, you know, when she says, I never saw a tree that was no tree in particular. It's always in the particulars that these questions are best raised, I think.
I am so glad that you corrected me, because I was a little worried you were extremely optimistic, but now I see it's much more about the donuts. So I actually want to quote the Ann Dillard quote from your book, Jeff, which I thought was beautiful. The point of going somewhere like the Napo River in Ecuador is not to see the most spectacular anything. It is simply to see what is there. We are here on the planet only once and might as well get a feel for the place. So this now leads me to Sylvia, where she's writing about places that are not here. And I want to read just a short passage from one of the sections. So the book is constructed similarly to Calvino's book, in that there are each section is called countries and something, countries and memory, countries and eyes, so on. So this one is countries and the dead. Most people who travel the globe seek to increase their knowledge, to expand themselves. They hope to understand their own country better by understanding others, in the same way that a reader seeks works in translation, to expand their awareness of humanity, as a parent takes a child to the zoo, to broaden their thought, as a Sunday afternooner goes to an art museum or a concert. The visitor braves Thanistan in order to reach some wisdom beyond any temporal one. She is, as all travelers to Thanistan are likely to be, some species of philosopher whose mind goes alight at mention of the eternal. So my question, since I know you were also trained as a philosopher, what made you want to visit all these imaginary countries, and what were you looking for? Jeff has amply demonstrated that there are plenty of places to visit on this planet. So what drew you to the parables?
Thank you for that question, and it's great to be on a panel with all of you discussing these issues. We're already getting right into a really central question about travel, which is, as you say, there are these specific moments where, you know, it can only be this street in this country or this river in this country, and then there's the sort of abstraction away from that. And my stories, which are called Invisible Countries, in a deliberate reference, obviously, to Calvino, are these parables. I'm not likening myself to him, but just borrowing his idea, in a way, of inventing geographies that allow you to explore what it's like to feel different ways of feeling displaced, different contours that countries might have that capture some feeling of alienation or loneliness. The first line of the story that Olivia just quoted from is, you don't have to be dead to travel to Afghanistan, but it helps. Because it's a very arid country, and everybody there is dead, so it's very quiet, which appeals to me. Some of these countries I'd quite like to go to. So I think, and then I mostly write more realistic fiction. My novels tend to be based in reality and in known places. But I've had interesting conversations with writers over the years about to what degree, when you make the decision to be specific about a place that you're setting a story, and at what points you describe something that's very like New York, but you don't name it. I was earlier speaking with a brilliant Irish writer, Emer McBride, who has two novels, and the first of which she does not name Ireland. She does not name the big city that the young woman goes off to study in, for reasons that she explained, that she wanted the readers to be able to feel a connection with that character without getting hung up on that particular county in Ireland that they might not know. But then in the second novel, she was specific about elements of London and the geography of London. So I don't have a straightforward answer to the question of which allows more proximity to readers, specificity or this kind of abstraction. But I've worked in both tones in different fictions I've written, I guess.
So this leads nicely to my question for Carrie, which is once again about the very, very specific. And I have to read a little Calvino again. So here's a little passage from Calvino that was brought to mind by reading Carrie's book. Marco Polo describes a bridge stone by stone. But which is the stone that supports the bridge? Kublai Khan asks. The bridge is not supported by one stone or another, Marco answers, but by the line of the arch that they form. Kublai Khan remains silent, reflecting. Then he adds, why do you speak to me of the stones? It is only the arch that matters to me. Polo answers, without stones, there is no arch. So your book is full of detailed memories, exquisite details, colors and scents. I got so hungry reading this book. Oh, my God. You just have to be prepared. The foods, the flowers, the fabrics, it's very sensory. And there are also a lot of actual archways.
Yes, there are.
And I wondered if the arch is meaningful to you, this kind of magical communal construction where the stones cooperate to form this shape, which has its own inherent stability, or if it's just an architectural element that comes up a lot in France. I have a follow-up question, but I'll let you answer that first.
Okay. Well, anyway.
Microphone.
Well, anyway, that's the part you missed. Now you're all up to speed. Thank you again for sponsoring this panel, and it's delightful to be here with you. Thank you for coming. What I will say about this poem is when I first began writing it, the first line was, a woman begins to pluck her eyebrow. She is after the perfect arch. That was where the book started. So and then shortly after that, the arches kept coming back in all forms. And I think in the very last piece in the book, it describes the arch as an architectural detail that is about longing for both heaven and earth. And that is really how I experience it. I mean, I think, there are notions of longing for heaven and then falling back to earth. But for me, it's really about longing for both heaven and earth. And as soon as I get too far away from earth, I begin to want to taste a perfectly ripe pear. So I want both. And
That's beautiful. And once again, I feel like I played that right into you played right into my hands. So I want to ask John about this issue of the sensory. many people, and I'm guilty of this myself, especially in grant applications, will talk about translation as a way of traveling through a reading experience, having a window into another world and another life. You argue that it's necessary to have sensory reference points outside your own nation in order to feel empathy. And I'd like you to talk about that. Why do you think that is?
Well, if I say the color blue, or if you even say the name White Sands, your mind is going to, you're not going to feel White Sands. You're going to imagine if you've stood on White Sands, and you're going to remember vaguely what that felt like. And I think one of the great things that literature does is it expands beyond our experience, the realm of sensory experience. And so we aren't, when Jeff talks about White Sands, he's taking you not to the White Sands he went to, and he's not taking you back to the White Sands you went to. He's taking you to a place in between. And in a way, that's to me what translation does. It gives us a kind of prosthetic access to worlds we don't really have access to. And you know, one of the things I love, for example, about Jeff's work is that you can take Jeff anywhere, and he will be incredibly English. And so even if Jeff is longing for California, while he's in California, he will still be quintessentially English. And it is that sort of Jeffness which comes across in his books. And I think as an editor, one of the things I'm always looking for is people that cannot help but be themselves as writers. It's not about personas. It's not about jokes. You know, one of the things I love about Sylvia's new book is that it, you know, Metaphysical Club, her first novel, is a kind of cathedral of ideas. And she's managed to smush that down into 62 pages in this new book. And Carrie is doing something very similar. She's basically giving you an entire life in the course of a book. And so I think when we read, we're not sort of, it's very easy to talk about crossing borders, which is very often a kind of pantheistic way to try to make everyone whose borders are used against them often to discriminate against them to relax about their borders. That's not what we're talking about. There's something actually kind of cognitive, I think, that happens, and especially to me, it builds out of the senses. It builds out of the way that you can make someone go to that place in between. And for me, poetry does that the most because there's fewer words. And one of the things I come across often as a professor of creative writing is my students don't use the senses anymore. You know, it's like there's somehow the senses have been browned out. And my only theory about this is that they spend so much time interacting virtually through screens that they've forgotten that, you know, Carrie's sweater is kind of nibbly and Jeff has a lovely citrus scent to him. You know,
he's trying to get back in my good books now.
Yeah. but this, without those things, and the best travel writers to me are completely drunk on the senses. I still remember I was rereading Pico Iyer's books before coming here because I'm talking to him later, and he describes the sort of high dusty tidiness to a Japanese street, and I can almost feel like what that's like walking down a street in Kyoto, and there's no dirt or dust anywhere.
So, Carrie, you, as I said before, really are drawn to the sensual. And there's a great passage in your poem, Twirl, I'm going to read, that embodies this, I think, really well. She's been following her nose all morning. No guidebook, no map. She's just followed it to the fleuriste, to the fromagerie, to the parfumerie. Though now, for some reason, without the scent of anything guiding her, she leaves the late morning sunlight and walks beneath a stone arch. Groundwater, she thinks, before the dampness like cool hands on her body even registers. I'm curious about, you wrote this book dreaming of France, not living in France or walking through France or remembering France. What is it about the sensory that is dreamy to you? Because in a way you could say that the sensory things are what is really concrete and is the source of our very specific memories. So why dreaming and
all this detail?
Yeah, well, and what? can you dream with the smell of the fromagerie?
Oh, well, that's a good question. Let me just say that when I started this book, I had I noticed one day that a huge corner of my imagination had been taken over by France, and that a lot of my fantasy life took place in France. And I thought, huh. And there was either a kind of decision to probably ignore that or decide to cure myself of that, or, you know, just really to turn towards it and take a very good look and see what that was about. So the book has always been dreaming of France from the very beginning. And I think that I'm not sure if I'm going to exactly answer your question, but I'm going to. Okay. So basically, I began with this whole notion of dreaming of France, and I think when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s in Iowa and Nebraska, after World War II, France. France's economy was totally decimated, and one of the ways they decided to pull out of that downward spiral of their economy was through luxury brands. And so they were so effective that even though I was this little girl in Iowa and Nebraska, I was aware of things like couture, and that American women who were very knowing and exotic, all went to France and came back, you know. So, of course, when I finally made it to France, I wasn't buying couture, right? And for me, it was really more about those moments, like the perfectly ripe peach that I keep. There is no peach in this book, but I keep getting back to. And I think for me, there is something about those moments that wake one up to one's life. In other words, it is the sensual experience of that beautiful piece of fruit, that lovely bar of soap, that, you know, are the ones that make us feel present. And for many of us, those have kind of a transcendent quality. So
that's perfect, because I want to move from transcendence to disappointment. So Jeff,
the microphone.
Yeah, you know this is for you. You've written quite a lot about disappointment, and what I love about it is that you'll really go into the details of how disappointing something is and how annoying and frustrating and how you wish you could do it all over again and do it differently, and then you're at peace with it.
Well, I'm not sure, but I mean, although I was so itching to disagree with John when he was talking about me as this Englishman in California. I mean, it's certainly true, I think, if you're English, by the time, and you grow up in England, by the time you're 10, you've really had that taste of ashes in the mouth. Is really, that's the taste of England. You know, you've had so much, on the level of weather, really. You know, we have these lovely things that can go on in the summer. You know, when I was about 12, I was crazy about this space rock band, Hawkwind, and they came to play a free concert in my town outdoors, and you know, it was pouring with rain, and they didn't turn up. And by then, I mean, that was kind of the last straw, but. one of the things about the last straw is just like humble pie. Even though it might be the last, that doesn't prevent you encountering another 1,000 last straws. So it's part of the my national makeup in a way that I think is not the. You, in America, you don't have quite the capacity for disappointment than we do, for all sorts of reasons. Partly because you're more inclined to do something about it. And it's also a way of just being more, of articulating one's experiences honestly. And I mean, there's a bit in the book, though, where I realized as I went through White Sands how often this thing of disappointment came up, and I realized it was a theme. But equally, though, I'm also conscious that there's that long tradition of British writers who are going around the world really just with a sort of satirical view. And of course, there's an imperial dimension to that. So let's say Evelyn Waugh is the classic embodiment of that. You know, Don DeLillo, in one of his books, says the art of getting on in New York consists of expressing dissatisfaction in interesting ways. And I certainly didn't want to become one of that tradition of British writers who were sort of condemned to only view the world sarcastically. So what I would say is that I really hope, and I believe that the that those enumerations of disappointment in no way have in no way inhibited my capacity to feel wonder or let's leave it at wonder, really, like that. And I even take that a stage further in the book by saying, actually, you know, although it sucks to be disappointed, I sort of turn that around and realize that actually the capacity for disappointment is a side effect of how much I still expect from the world. Because in a way, when one is no longer capable of disappointment, what does that mean? It means one's achieved a state of resignation. Whereas I'm always eager to, you know, I feel that I'm always eager for the next chance of experiencing wonder or astonishment or whatever superlative would be most appropriate. There. Yes, although I do insist that I've achieved the apotheosis of donuthood.
Just that if I would speak to that, I mean, partly one of the reasons that your work has always spoken to me, I grew up partly in England, and so I have a part of my sensibility is that, too, when you mentioned the weather, I was just thinking about the fact that when my son here plays tennis, and if there's ever like any sort of moisture on the ground, the match is canceled because it would be far too dangerous. And I literally played tennis in the pouring rain in England because you sort of made do with what was there. But that is also reminding me, or make me think of something about the point you raised, John, about why there's less sensory detail. It's a really interesting question. Why are students writing with less of that kind of detail in their work? And I think I was just, this is really pure speculation, but when I think about how specifically very different England was from California when I was living there in the 70s, I mean, it was in a sensory way, particularly in relation to food and light, the lack of light, and the fact that there were about 3 vegetables that you could buy total. My mother used to sort of smuggle in masa harina corn flour so she could make tortillas. There's a little taste of California. But anyway, it just seems to me that distances, probably falsely, but feel collapsed now because people travel so much and see. It really strikes me that that growing up now, you just see the world feels so accessible to you. And I think that's probably an illusion. But I think, I wonder if that collapses some of that sense of how specifically different.
I completely agree, and I think it enacts itself on a syntactical level in writing. So I'm going to make a grand essentialist generational generalization here, but I think an English writer might say he entered the room and there was a group of chairs malingering in the corner. the smell of wet tea filled the air, and everything would, except for the individual, would have an active verb, would be anthropomorphized. And I think American writers in general, not all of them, of course, tend to see their characters as actors. And so they, Annie Dillard, who's a mutual friend of ours, has this brilliant book called The Writing Life, and one of her many sort of Catherine Wheeled quotes that comes sparking off this book is, all the action is in the verbs. And you read anything by Annie Dillard, and the verbs are just incredible. They're sort of, they've been in the gym working the P90X machine, and they've got sort of, you know, stipples on their muscles, and it's, and she just uses the language to the extent that it can be used. And one of the things I find, to come back to what you were just saying, is because when you sit in front of a screen and reality is presented to you, the way to present that back as a version of reality is in the passive tense, is to use a passive verb. Because we go to a movie and the world is presented for us. We don't imagine the world. And so a lot of my students, I think, are they write like Murakami. They use a lot of passive verbs, simple verbs, and they assume in some ways, they sort of gesture at tropes. And so they assume a kind of collective agreement upon what the world looks like and what the genres are, and then use the whiffs that come off of those things to create a kind of thing called narrative. And one of the things I was trying to do in my poems was to try to look at the world as it is. And I think the best travel writers, and some of them are on this table, look at the world as it is, and its strangeness, its disappointments, and are completely willing to accept those things. But you have to go and look at it and experience it. And Jeff has a book out right now on Gary Winogrand and his photography, which builds a sort of beautiful portrait of how the way he looked at the world through the camera was not as a film. He had an ethical kind of moral component to the way he arranged a frame. And I think as a travel writer, or as any kind of writer, you're always creating a frame. And you have to think about that when you step back and edit your work. Otherwise, you might be looking at a frame that is leaving a lot of people out of it, or that is flattering you as the viewer, or is trying to flatter the reader.
Yeah. Sort of so interested by this idea of this sort of browning out of the senses, and I think this is, it's got, I think you're right, John, it must be to do with the you know, the pervasiveness of the screen. I just wonder as well if it might be the way that now you know, travel is so not a big deal, and people are, from such an early age, they're all over the world. And, you know, I didn't, I mean, just this might seem sort of extraordinary. Both of my parents are both dead now. They both died without ever having been on an aeroplane. I didn't get on a plane until I was 22. And so that meant that when I first got on, you know, it was extraordinary to get on a ferry to this place, France, you know. Now, of course, by the time people are five, they've been all over the place. So, and the whole idea, now you can get sort of, you know, of course you can get fruits from all over the world at any time of the year. The world has become a lot less local in many ways. Anyway.
Oh, okay. I think I was going to say two things. If you have young children and you're thinking about schools and you don't want them to end up in a brownout, look at Montessori schools. I have to tell you, I was the director of a Montessori school for a very long time. And with young children, there is a tremendous education of the senses. And she started with things like there were these, they used to be made out of silk. There were color tablets, and there would be gradations of colors and great matching and all kinds of things. So maybe I got retrained a little in all those years where I thought I was teaching the children. So if you don't want the brownout, think about Montessori schools. And the other thing I think I want to say about my book and all of that detail and the sensory detail is that my characters are much like me. They keep drifting off in their imaginations. I mean, constantly drifting off in their imaginations. And when you have, so what I'm saying is that part of the detail is very helpful, because when your characters keep making these leaps into the imagination, if they're really well grounded in those details of their current place before they have that imaginative leap, then it's easier to go with them on the leap, because you are more grounded first. And then wherever they leap to, if that is equally tangible in the same way, it is easier to make the leap and go there. And then if you happen to come back, you know, that's a possibility too.
I just want to jump in here because these her poems are really wonderful and strange. And I think one of the things that literature ought to be is kind of strange. If it's too easily digestible, is in some ways not doing the job of reality. Because every experience I have of being displaced or just moving from one part of the room to another, there is estrangements that happen. And I was, as you were speaking, I was thinking about, you know, what do we travel for? I think that is a big question. Jeff has a book called The Ongoing Moment, which is about photography. And one of the points he makes in there about photography is that at a certain point, photography became a kind of circular loop because photographers realized that they were taking pictures of other pictures rather than taking pictures. And I've done this in Paris where I've stood on a bridge and I took a picture and I was really happy. It's like the river's going both ways and there's an island. And I realized I was taking an André Kertész photograph without realizing it. And I think on top of the screens and what they do to us about the senses, we live in such a heavily mediated world that we are traveling. I don't think it travel is just more mundane. I think we also are traveling in some ways looking for the thing that we already know we're going there for, and we feel discomfort or frustration or even guilt if we don't go and see, you know, the blue mosque in Istanbul or whatever that is that we're supposed to be looking at. And then we go there, what do? We take our phones out and take a picture, because if we haven't documented that we've been there, then it hasn't happened. And so we're often putting in front of ourselves a scrim that takes away the attention we would normally be paying attention to the senses. And this is why Sylvia's book is so wonderful, because it scrambles every attempt to try to consume the places that she takes you to.
I mean, thank you for characterizing it that way. But it's interesting when you were talking before about how we draw the frame. One way I dispensed with the anxiety of that question was to create these frameless geographies, in the sense that the geographies come from my mind and my imagination, and they're sort of essences of different ways you feel lost when you're traveling, or, you know, the experience. I mean, the first story just has the very common experience of not being in the system where you think you're supposed to be staying, and they've lost you, and what it feels like to be, but I have my numbers here. These are the numbers that tell you that I'm supposed to be here, and the person who at that point controls what seems to be your entire fate says, you know, we don't have you in our system. And just without wanting to put that on a specific country or language or landscape, you know, just some of those feelings of being displaced. And so in some ways that freed me from, you know, these specific details, and just were, it was a way of trying to capture other elements of travel in a way, because I don't know how to write about travel or even how to experience travel without sort of, gosh, I better go to the place that I'm supposed to take the picture of, and I better take the picture, although for who, you know, who might take, you know.
Actually, I want to quote from one of John's poems. He receives a Christmas card from his father and the second wife, and he says, I wonder what it is I'm supposed to witness other than a happiness. I wonder who this picture is for. And I do feel that, I mean, I'm not going to go into Facebook discussion, but that is one of my main problems with that kind of social media, is that there is this constant placement of here's where I am and here's what I'm doing and you're not there and you're not doing that. And I think that has created, I mean, I just feel that that's created a more fractured, even among our friends, you know, a fractured experience. I was interested, John, that you wrote or said something about how protests happen in public spaces, and how, you know, Trump rules on Twitter, which is a digitized space because he doesn't have enough supporters to actually fill a real space. And I'm interested about this, and Jeff has written about how a place can induce a vision of its own demise. And I wonder if public places, I mean, even public places like everybody reads the New York Times or everybody watches, you know, Walter Cronkite, if public spaces are sort of on the wane for us in a way that we don't know how to gather. I mean, I know we've had the women's marches and the other protests and so on, but I feel that in some ways we've lost shared spaces in the real world, you know, and I hope I'm wrong. And so I ask you, are we losing them or gaining them? Are they on the rise?
Well, I mean, it's I've really got to try to get through saying this without getting terribly upset. You know, this question that you've raised is so it's just so important. It's particularly important today, which, as many of you know, I mean, it wasn't just me being rude earlier on, forgetting to say how pleased I was to be here today. It's because also I wanted to say it in this context. You know, I'm really glad to be here in the Bay Area today, even though it's an incredibly sad day, because, as many of you know, Larry Harvey died today. And this thing of people gathering in the actual world, I mean, we all know that the most important, probably cultural, social gathering is the thing that, you know, that he brought about. And although it happens in Nevada, you know, it completely grows out of so many of the values of the Bay Area. And of course it happens in the, you know, that Black Rock City arises in the middle of nowhere. But, you know, so much a part of that Burning Man ethos, which was technologically driven, it was also, you know, it was the crucial thing is that it happened nowhere. And of course that thing of hyphenating those words now here was so at the heart of that thing. And it was such an important, although it was sort of underwritten by all the kind of, you know, technological advances that we associate with this part of the world, it was an actual gathering of actual people where they could become, you know, become more than themselves precisely because it was a public gathering anyway. So, you know, it's a really major day today, of course, the fact that that Larry has passed. Anyway, that's my thought about that.
I think we are losing public spaces, whether it's Burning Man or... I think public spaces in general are transformative because they often put us into a place which is not our own, and they put us in contact with people who are different than us. Everyone is different than us in small ways and big ways. And we've been living more and more on our time in a digital world where we've commodified ourselves. We've become kind of data collection devices for selfhood with the idea that somehow we're enacting ourselves when in fact we're just creating giant collection devices for other companies to sell our data, to sell stuff back to us. And on the back of this, we've lost newspapers, we've lost post offices across England, they've lost pubs. That sounds ridiculous, but if you've ever been to a really good pub, there are children there, there are grandmothers there are friends there are enemies there. But the fact is that you could gather in those places, and this country, as far as I can tell, was built on the idea of public spaces. You know, Penn's Woods began with, you know, a church which had the news printed on the outside of it. And I think the other week, Dave Eggers passed through New York, and I bumped into him, and we were talking. And I had that sounds terrible, but let's get over that. And we were talking because I just watched something where a friend of mine had written an essay about a horrific thing that had happened to him. And I made the mistake of going on Twitter to see what the response to this essay was. And most of it was great and fabulous and terrific. But immediately, right after that, it was, but what about this? Which is the response to almost everything on Twitter. And Dave was really quick about it. He just said, you know what? That's the internet. That's not people. You know, that's people on the internet. That's how they behave. And so if we have any chance of, I think, getting along together in the public space, because as far as I can tell, none of us live virtually. We still have to feed ourselves and drink and sleep and eat and poop and everything. We're going to have to reclaim some of those public spaces. And so these marches, although some of them seem to have fizzled, they created all kinds of intersectional other groups, like women marching with people of color who've been harassed by the police, have created other small groups. And if we can actually get into public spaces more, I don't think Trump has a chance, to be honest, because I think people will realize that he is basically ruling us with half of his robot Twitter followers and using the kindness of people to put up with him to enrich himself and his friends. And I'm sorry that's political, but we're living through an emergency.
This
yeah.
This is good.
All right. Thanks.
No, I'm done. I just was going to say, you're good. You're in Berkeley.
I like the fact that in this room, there's one of the different headings. World unity is kind of beckoning us from the distance.
Next to Poland
under threat, which is not so good. But actually, sort of a few topics ago, I was going to say about places where people gather. If I think about where I've been in the last month or two, where there have been groups of people that I've been with, it's either been in airports or on an airplane. You know, so these places of transition, which I guess Pico Iyer has certainly written about. I don't know if you'll be talking about that. But that just, it seems, I love this idea of reclaiming the public square, and certainly the march right after the inauguration definitely was powerful that way, and made it seemed like a moment where we were actually, you know, out in the streets. But otherwise, we're in these transitional spaces so often when we're with other people, you know.
This might seem strange, like that we're on a travel panel talking about protesting, but I think they're intimately related. That if we didn't have to go and physically be someplace, none of us would travel. We would just look at the pictures on computer screens. It's such a pain in the ass to do it, to get on a plane, to go through the security. That sounds like first world problems, and it is. But still, doing all that stuff can be annoying. You know, it could be 15 hours before someone is gently massaging your feet. But I think people want to be in the world. They want to be around other people to some degree. And I think part of the reason that travel is so illuminating is just the chance to be in a different group. You know, that moment as a traveler, I think that's ideal, is when you kind of forget yourself and you're just sort of moving through a city or a place, almost like Emerson's Invisible Eye.
Well, it's that strange thing, isn't it, that so often the brochures of places, whether it's clubs, restaurants, or resorts, so often they say, this is an exclusive place. And, you know, that's the bait. But then actually it requires a tiny bit of reflection to realize that actually so much of our happiness comes from the opposite of that, from being in a place that's inclusive. And, of course, if you spend any of time at the, you know, you go with your husband or wife to one of these resorts and you know, it's nice, you have dinner and you look around, there's all these other murmuring couples. You know, it's actually a dismal scene as you just murmur away, and you can't risk saying anything because the general level of murmuring is so low. And then if occasionally, you know, at these places there's also the option of a communal table. And except for maybe, you know, this doesn't even, you know, then, of course, it's amazing that then, once the communal table opens up, all these murmuring couples descend on it, almost like vultures, because we can't wait, actually, to be properly sort of, you know, interacting with each other again.
I went earlier today to hear the amazing Kenyan writer Ngugi Wa Thiong'o speak, and he was just talking about his experience in prison in Kenya decades ago, but how he just was talking about human beings needing company, and obviously that's one of the reasons that's what's taken away from people in prison initially.
Okay, I'm going to ask one last question of all of you. When you travel, do you use maps?
No, I don't. I love getting lost. I have to sort of circle round and round and round the hotel and go in wider and wider loops. And I do that as soon as I arrive. Because someone, this is probably an urban legend, but told me that for every hour you change, if you run or walk a mile upon arrival, it will sort out your jet lag. So if you switch 12 hours, you have to walk or run 12. And I've sort of lived by that, but I think it works. I'm still here.
Well, I used to use those big fold-out maps when I traveled, and now I often find myself using the little maps that they give you at the hotel. And the thing that's so interesting about those maps is that they are suggestions of maps. So they're all missing lots of streets. And you, okay, so really you walk out into the world with one of those maps, and you know you're going to have an adventure. And you know, as one of my friends says, one of my superpowers is loving to ask questions. So and I look completely non-threatening, so I can wander around with one of those little half map things and ask people all kinds of questions and directions, and people are always very helpful. And then the trick is to not be in a hurry. So, yeah, that's an answer to your question. You know, I will say, though, about this whole public space and groups, one of the most profound travel experiences I ever had was when I went to the interior of Borneo and was in a group there. It was obviously an entire village and a community, and it was the only place I'd ever been where people were about my size. And the men were just a couple inches taller than me. Some of the women were my size, a few were smaller. And it was like the whole world, everything, the great setup for life became clear, because suddenly I understood, you know, that there was this kind of alignment of mouth to mouth, genital to genital, which I had sort of missed out on my whole life. And it was like, wow, this is interesting. Suddenly the world became much more sexualized. That was a real aha moment. And then the other one that came out of that was this sense of really being eye to eye with people. When I was standing around having conversations, and I realized that I walk around with a much larger sense of personal space because other people's faces are up there somewhere. And so after travel experiences like that, why would you stay home?
Well, I have a sort of, I'll come to the maps question in a moment, but I have a similar kind of thing that I've been going to China recently. I just love going to China. And there's all sorts of reasons to love it. But one of the reasons it occurred to me is, I mean, you know, I have no brothers or sisters. And then I go to China where I've got, I don't know how many people live there. There's a lot. You know, I've got all these brothers and sisters, all these other people who are only children. And I feel this great sense of sort of belonging there, you know. On the question of maps, I think that was a trick question, Olivia, because on the one hand, you know, the response would be, no, I don't use maps, I'm too cool. But actually, the thing is, I think the answer is, yes, I use maps. Aren't I cool not to be just relying on my phone? So I think now using these old paper fold-out maps has become the equivalent of just doing the Dylan thing and using ideas as your maps.
That's great. I was thinking about getting to know London when I moved to London, and how the different ways you can know London. And I realized that I know the tube map London. That was probably the London I knew first, which is this, you know, as you probably know, this fantastically abstract map that doesn't really correspond to how the city works, but it's very comprehensible. And it allows you to get around, those are two great essences. And then slowly you become disillusioned as you realize that this station, you know, is miles from this station that it appears to be so near. So then I think I graduated to the A to Z, which is this, you know, Bible. And it's a book, and that was very confusing to have a whole book about the city, and you had to know whether your street that you were looking for was on page 24 or page 24 and also page 61. And that sort of trying to have a book correspond to a city, that was an educational process, a learning process, trying to map the city I knew on my feet with this book. And then now getting around my phone instead, the thing about using maps on your phone is that you're just seeing this tiny little space. So it's really interesting the different sort of perspectives it gives you on the city.
I think these things are always complicated, though. So for the talk of London and maps, of course, makes us think of this, you know, wonderful thing which is in danger of being lost. You know, the way that you used to be able to get into a black cab and you'd say to somebody, "I want to go to this tiny street," and he'd go and he'd get it. And they would, you know, there's that lovely, amazing apprenticeship that taxi drivers used to have to do in London called the knowledge. And it was an amazing skill and it was great. On the other hand, I never used to take taxis because they were so expensive and because the taxi drivers were such a grumpy old bunch, you know. And it's actually now so much, it's actually a more pleasant experience to just be Ubered round by somebody relying entirely on the lack of knowledge represented by the app.
I like the way Sylvia said the map is this little, on the phone is this little tiny, and I think that really says so much. What you're looking at on your phone is a little tiny thing. It's always a little tiny thing compared to the wide world. So with that, we're going to open it up to this large audience for questions of any of our panelists.
If you'd like to ask a question, would you please meet us right over here, and we'll let them ask from the aisle here. Just form a line for us, if you would.
Oh, oops, sorry. I'm so used to grabbing the microphone, but you want it. Okay. Thanks for speaking. I had one question for John, one question for Jeff. So I'm just deciding which one to ask first. But Jeff, when you were talking about China, I wanted to ask you what you meant by children, because like my mind is going in all different directions, and I'm like when you said that you felt like there were children, I didn't understand that. Was that the height thing, or
I hope it wasn't like? Oh no, God! I know I certainly wasn't saying Chinese people are all children. No, what I was saying is because of the only being allowed one child that policy. I'm suddenly in a country where everyone is like me, an only child.
Oh, okay, I see. I was thinking about, I was like, oh, I hope you're not molesting kids, or I don't know. Sorry, my brain is everywhere.
No, well, I'm really glad we've clarified that.
Sorry about that. Thank you for clarifying.
I don't have any Gary Glitter-like tendencies.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't. You know, I don't know. It's first time seeing you guys. But thank you. Thank you for. I didn't catch that part because I was in the back. But let's see. Oh, John. Sorry, I was going to call you Jeff. Thank you, Jeff. Okay, so John, you're a professor, and that's really awesome. So I'm wondering, like, do you do anything like challenge your students to like kind of do like a smartphone detox, or say like, hey, like this is an assignment, you have to be off your phone, or I don't know, just, you know, like, and then see how it feels like not to like be on your phone and write, or, you know, pay attention to stuff? Because I'm on the generation of the cusp where I know life without like pre-internet, and I know life after internet. So I'm kind of in the middle.
Yeah, the closest thing I guess would be I do give them sensory exercises. Usually building off whenever I've taught Saul Bellow or other writers that are like that are really earthy and that use a lot of sensory input. It's impossible to tell them to get off their phones. So the closest thing I can do is I've often asked them to take a picture diary and then to try to write into what they see. Because I think one of the things that Jeff points out in his Gary Winogrand book and just good photographs in general are so full of mystery. And so if you go around and try to take pictures, not of things that you feel like you should take pictures of, but just of what interests you, it will tell you what interests you in a way. And I think that sometimes can be a way to unlock what your unconscious mind is always doing, but you don't often give it a chance to create out of, if that makes any sense.
I think that's a great idea, but I also, it's interesting when I was traveling, like, I just got my first smartphone like 2 years ago, and then I traveled for 10 months, and that was very helpful. But before that, I kind of did really old school. And, you know, I would take pictures, and then, you know, like I started getting dirty, the lens, and I got cracks in it. I would take pictures, and it was hard. It just, even when it was good, like, there's this difference when you see it, like, in person versus, like, on a screen. Because, like, if you think about it, everything is 2D, and it's, like, you're really not getting the full experience. And I have, maybe I'm just not very, like, maybe I'm more anti-technology, but I feel like... even with virtual reality, it's not going to give you the full experience. It's all like illusion anyways. You can't really substitute it, even though they try to sell and market it. That's capitalism. Thank you.
I don't know who my question's for. It's whoever it resonates with. So on the maps question, what it brought up for me was that I was actually excited to realize that I would no longer be unfolding a map in public as a foreigner, that I could... the thing about looking at a phone is that it's not obvious that you're looking at a map or that you could be, you know, more local. So what that also brings up for me is that sort of like very self-conscious, like navigating the line where, you know, you know you're always going to be seen as a foreigner, and there's in ways in which you're obvious that you don't even realize and you could never erase, but then you're always also trying to, like, so I don't know, any thoughts on like find that line and like where that comes from, where that feeling comes from, and how you you know, you both do as you do in Rome, but you also you're real as you are. And also being someone who, you know, it also invites people to, you know, when you're a foreigner, it invites people to interact with you in certain ways that are positive.
Well, I have had that experience of being uncomfortable opening a map in public because it does signal... you know, it does signal that you are a person who may be somewhat disoriented, and so there is a kind of vulnerability about that. And my mind started thinking about that, so I didn't hear all of your question. But I do understand that, and I also think that, I know one of the things that has come up for me, well, first of all, you know, as the older I get, I think I have a sense of, in certain ways, maybe feeling more physically vulnerable. And so the idea of opening up a map is like another level of vulnerability. But I might feel a little more acutely than I did when I was younger. But I also think that one of the things that we have to contend with, or that I have to contend with, is feeling uncomfortable being a newbie, is feeling uncomfortable not knowing things, and that you know, one of the greatest things that can happen in life is to get more comfortable with being a person who doesn't know, and that persona, and being more comfortable when you are a newbie.
I think
we just all grow up thinking we're supposed to know everything.
I just want to give a shout out for maps because I think they're really beautiful. And I also like to keep old maps. I keep one of my neighborhood that has all the old restaurants that aren't there anymore that were my favorite, the little cafe. And, you know, I still have an atlas from the 90s that has a big sticker on the front that says "New Soviet Changes," and a lot of I like to see maps from different eras of, I mean, especially San Francisco, which has changed so rapidly. So, and I just think they're beautiful tactile things, but I don't like to travel with them because I'm short too. Yeah,
I mean, one of the interesting questions, which could be a whole panel in itself, that this raises is the question of belonging and who belongs in a place and who doesn't, and it seems like there's a whole sort of spread across many parts of the world right now is an increased and very vocal anxiety about what it is to belong, and that which presumably comes from the fact that it's not, you can't tell as easily as you used to be able to, which in many ways probably for most of us on the panel seems a positive, you know, that you know, our communities are more diverse and we are more connected to other people in other countries, but that's clearly creating, you know, imagined disaster in some people.
Yeah, it was one of the things that I first liked when I came to America, because in Britain we'd always speak about community. And, of course, there'd always be different kinds of communities, like we'd hear about the Muslim community or this community or that community. And it seemed to me that was always defined in part by who was excluded from it, who was not a member of that community. I always liked the American emphasis, not on community, but on neighborhood, because then anybody who lived within the geographical confines of that unit, the neighborhood, was a part of it, irrespective of what their identity was, although I'm not naive enough to think that those neighborhoods didn't often overlap with certain kind of identities.
Thank you for today. I was just actually wondering, in terms of belonging, where do you feel you belong the most, and does it have to be a place called home, or is belonging elsewhere other than home?
Well, actually, there's another great quote from Calvino about how Marco Polo never talks about his hometown, and Kublai Khan asks him, you know, why do you never talk about Venice? And he said, I'm always talking about Venice. I can't describe any place without talking about Venice. But I'm afraid if I name Venice, it will be erased. And there is, I actually was interested in this notion of writing something and having that replace your memories and the original experience kind of disappearing because you've written it down. Anyway, that has nothing to do with anything. I am from Southern California, but I'm an Italian translator, so I often feel that I am physically a Californian, and I am somehow intellectually an Italian. Fortunately, not politically. It's just as bad over there. So anyone else want to answer that?
I would just say that I think that feeling, a sense of belonging, is so crucial to one's well-being and one's sense of happiness. And I think one of the wonderful things about London historically is that it's really been given so many people from so many different kind of walks of life and so many different just preferences a place to belong, which is quite interesting because that's a product partly of the English not welcoming with open arms kind of thing, but more just a kind of indifference, you know. I don't care who you are, what you do, just, you know, do it quietly and don't disturb me. All I care about is the fact there's still beer in the pub on a Saturday kind of thing. So I really like that about London. I'd also say that it's, given that I know how important it is to me for a sense of belonging, I've ended up living in a place where I feel I could live there for the next 70 years and still not feel any real sense of belonging. That place being, and I know because you just love this kind of stuff, that sort of opposition, and that place is Los Angeles.
This is strange on maybe on a panel about travel, but the only place I really feel like I belong was the person I love. You know, that's when I'm with her, I feel like this is where I belong, and everywhere else is everywhere else. And part of one of the beauties of travel is to come back to someone, to have something to talk about and to say, this happened and I went here. And so I think it would be quite a lonely life. I'm always amazed at people like Bruce Chatwin. And I don't know, maybe he had a lover that for a long time. But I don't know how you could be a traveler without someone else. I think you'd have to be a different kind of human, like a sort of superhuman, you know, that sort of floating amidst with no sense of need or longing to belong to someone else. Because I think if you belong to someone else, you can go anywhere because you know where you really belong.
That seems so poetic. We should end there.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.